Eichinger says the carrier is cooperating with the FAA.
As with any FAA action, our intent is to support the FAA process in recognition of its authority as the regulatory body for the industry. So we're not offering any additional detail at this time on the FAA investigation.
Last year, the FAA said Southwest installed unapproved parts, but gave the carrier several months to correct the problem. For NPR News, I'm Bill Siebel in Dallas.
An expanded safety recall has been announced by Honda. The Japanese automaker says it's adding more than 400,000 older model vehicles to its recall for unsafe airbags. That recall was first announced more than a year ago. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world on the web at hewlett.org.
I'm Diane Adams. My friends call me Dee Dee. I was born blind. My husband worked with visually impaired older folks. He would talk about the radio reader. He'd say, I ordered this radio reader for so-and-so, and so one day I said, I would really love to have one of those.
At the Illinois Radio Reader, local newspapers, books, and magazines, and periodicals are read and recorded by over 70 volunteers, and then those programs are broadcast to those visually impaired people who have our radios in their homes.
It is literally our newspaper. I feel we as visually impaired people are so privileged to have a service like this. I'm Dee Dee Adams from Decatur, and WILL is my source for the Illinois Radio Reader.
WILL programs are made possible by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra, presenting To Stir the World on Friday, February 19th at 7:30 p.m. at Krannert Center. The program features Vienna-born Gernot Winneshofer on Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto in E minor, Opus 64. More information is available at 351-9139.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Having a little change of plans this morning, we were scheduled in the first hour to be talking with John Gant. He is associate professor in the Graduate School of Library and Information Science here at the U of I in Urbana-Champaign. We were going to be talking about e-government, electronic government, and he's stuck out on the East Coast, and we thought we'd just postpone this conversation until he can get back here and be with us in the studio. So we, in the first hour here now, we'll be going to the archives for a show that we ran back in November. It's a conversation with James McManus about his book, Cowboys Full. It's about poker and how it is that he says it's a very American kind of game. So for this first hour, that means we'll not be taking calls. Well, baseball may be America's pastime, but our guest in this hour, James McManus, says that poker is America's game. He says while more than a few politicians, historians, biographers, and editors have tried to minimize the game's importance, poker thinking naturally extends into many areas, including law, business, education, even artificial intelligence. This morning we'll be talking with James McManus about his new book, which is entitled Cowboys Full, The Story of Poker. It is a history of the game in America, and it's quite an interesting book. Whether you're a poker player or not, there would be something in there for you. It is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. It's a book that tells the story, I think he would say, tells the story of a game that maybe more than any other reflects who we are as Americans and how we operate. James McManus has covered poker for a number of publications, including the New York Times, the LA Times, Harper's, Card Player, ESPN.com, and the New Yorker. He's the author of the book Positively Fifth Street, which was his memoir of finishing fifth in the World Series of Poker Championship. That was in 2003. Came away with a tidy sum in six figures. He continues to write about poker, to teach the literature of poker, and to play poker. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. McManus, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And how are you?
I'm real good.
Good, good. Thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. So you've been playing poker for a long time. I read somewhere that, in fact, your grandparents taught you to play poker when you were 9 years old?
1960 in the Bronx, and then more advanced lessons a few miles up the road in Mayapack, New York, where they were building a little summer house. And we played for chips. I don't even remember how much the chips were worth, but it was a very low-stakes, friendly family game, but I the bug bit me, and 49 years later, I'm still playing.
What about it was so appealing for you, do you think?
Well, you know, I think a big part of it was having the opportunity to spend time with the grown-ups. You know, instead of playing children's games, I was sitting around in the evening. They were drinking beer and smoking cigarettes, and we were playing cards. And there seemed to be, from my 9-year-old perspective, an enormous amount of money at stake. And so that was a big part of the thrill. And the ability to trick people with a bluff, I guess, was that was entertaining for me.
Yeah. This may be an obvious question, but what do you think it is? What are the qualities of a great poker player?
You have to be able to pick up information, betting patterns, sometimes when you're not playing online, physical tells, facial expressions, and you have to be reasonably good at math. Poker math is fifth or sixth grade math, the same kind of questions and answers over and over again. You know, you've got four cards to a flush, there's nine diamonds left in the deck. There's 45 cards unseen, so you have roughly one out of five chance of hitting your diamond. And the most probably after that, the most important characteristic is you have to love to gamble. You can't, if you don't like putting your money out there in a speculative situation, you can't play. It's not going to be fun for you over the long haul. You just have to take too many risks in the course of even a single poker game that if your soul grinds its teeth while you're betting, you're not going to be very good at it.
And that, I guess here, and you've checked me on this, but it I think, at least the idea I have about poker is that, though compared with many other games of chance, that skill really does matter, and maybe more than in some other things where you're just spinning a wheel or you're tossing some dice.
There's no question that of all the casino games, you have no chance to win in the long run. Craps, blackjack, the house edge is such that the longer you play them, the more certain it becomes that you're going to lose. Whereas poker is a game in which by playing extremely well and getting a little bit lucky, you can make a very handsome living at it. There's no professional craps players or blackjack players unless they're cheating by counting cards, so that the skill factor, the intelligence quotient of poker is much, much higher than the other gambling games.
Yeah, but just going back to the thing that you said before, is that to be a player, you certainly can't be a successful player if you can't stand the chance that you're going to lose.
Right.
Gambling has to appeal to you. And this is, I think, that's gets the central argument you make about why it is that it's the American game. It has been so popular with Americans that seems that what you're arguing is that Americans, they like to gamble.
Well, we have what is called an immigrant's gene, immigrant's DNA in our system, owing to the fact that nearly 100% of the population of this country is descended from or are actually immigrants at this moment. So that, and that is a population that is made up of risk takers. Only about 2% of a native population leaves and goes, and, you know, takes the risk of crossing an ocean or crossing mountains in order to get to a new place where you might improve your chances at survival. The rest of the population is a bit more passive, more risk adverse. So it shouldn't be in any way surprising that America chose as its national card game, many believe as its national pastime, a gambling game in which the language is money.
And is that part of the explanation, perhaps, of why it is that we so much associate this game with the West, with the Western United States, with the myth of the West, with Western expansion, with that that spirit?
Well, poker comes into the country almost exactly at the point in which the Louisiana Purchase is made. In fact, in my book, I suggest that the symbolic birthday of poker, we don't know when the first hand was played in the United States, but the symbolic birthday should be July 4th, 1803, which is when news of the Louisiana Purchase arrives in Washington. At that point, the in size. Instead of hugging the eastern seaboard, it now extends all the way out to the Rockies or wherever it turned out that the headwaters of the Missouri existed. And it was the least risk-averse folks that moved up into that territory, and then after the Civil War, further west into the minefields of the Dakotas and Nevada and California, and got us to the Pacific Ocean.
And this is a game that you think you believe begins really in New Orleans.
Yeah, the French population there had a game called Poque, P-O-Q-U-E, which was played with 20 cards. Four players each received five-card hands. And the American, once New Orleans became American, there was more intermingling of the different populations. The English game of brag, which is played with a 52-card deck, allows for more players to participate and gives us opportunities to make straights and flushes. It's the combination of brag with poker that gives us what was called in the South poker, and then as it moves north on Mississippi steamboats, poker.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is James McManus. He has authored a new book that looks at the history of poker. The title of his book is Cowboys Full, and it is published by Ferrer Strauss Giroux. It's out just recently. You can look for it in the bookstore. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone in Belgium, line number four, right here. Hello.
Good morning. I'd like to interject a different thought about this than what you brought up, and maybe you mentioned it in your book. Like other folks, I've played the game and enjoy it immensely, and I play with a group of fellows that I've played with for 30-some years, okay? And now, I know professional gamblers, they find that as just nothing, and it's really, really a social event, and that's exactly what it is a social event. We get together, we have a good time with some old friends, and just renewing bonds, at the same time adding the adventure of risking a little bit of money. And it's small time. And you really haven't mentioned that aspect of it in your discussion.
Well, we're just getting started. I couldn't agree with you more that the vast majority of poker is played on a friendly basis with like-minded folks, friends, old and new, getting together. I mean, that's how most of the presidents played, including the current one, who went down to Springfield and found that an excellent way to break the ice with his fellow politicians was to start a poker game in State Senator Terry Link's basement. And that's how FDR played, Truman. Most presidents played to relax with their friends and cronies. And without question, you're right, and that is the fact that poker keeps people elbow to elbow all evening is what makes it such a wonderful networking tool, as well as a, you know, way to have pizza and beer and have a good time for a few hours.
Well, the reason I brought that up is because so much anymore you see on television, you see these huge games, or you know, they mention how many dollars it is, but when you really get down to it, that much money really doesn't change hands because they use chip type things, could be any value, but it seems to be just the money that's all in that. Where in the game that I play, it's really the social interacting.
Well, there's the kind of game that you play in, but also there are, you know, those chips have real value, and there are millions of dollars at stake. In the World Series, the total prize pool is usually over $250 million. So there's no question that there's real money involved in the higher stakes games. I'm not suggesting that those people have more fun than you and your buddies do, but, you know, there's the bottom line is that money is the language of poker, and it doesn't make any sense to play without money, because everybody would just call and until the river and see who happened to be lucky enough to be dealt the best hand. So that poker put money and poker are interchangeable, and poker doesn't make any sense without money.
Yeah, I agree totally, but what I'm saying is, for television, the draw for it is the big money, not really the game so much.
Yes. Well, I don't think it stops being a game. It becomes on TV a game for stakes. And the fact that the whole card cameras now reveal what the two players in the hand are holding, it gives the audience more information than the players who are contesting the pot have, and that makes it quite a bit more dramatic, especially when they're, you know, there's seven-figure sums at stake with the turn of a card.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This point that I think is interesting, in as much as the caller says, and you would agree that so much poker is played, it's played among friends, and it's played for recreation and just, you know, to have a good time. And yes, there may be small amounts of money changing hands, but that's maybe not the most important thing. And what's important is people getting together and having a good time. But it is also true that poker has become this big spectator sport. And I don't know when it was the first time that I was flipping through the channels and saw on ESPN that they were doing poker. And my first reaction was, what? You're televising a card game?
On a sports network.
I guess I can see why they would do that, both based on the game's popularity and the kind of drama that you just gave the example. So maybe that's why it is that people watch. But I guess it said something about the popularity of this game, the fact that it's now on television.
Well, I'd love to come back to the TV aspect of it and the kinds of games that are played at the World Series and on other televised tournaments. But to return to the point that I made earlier with the caller, he caught us very early in our conversation. We didn't have a chance to discuss all the friendly poker that had been played among ordinary folks up into the Oval Office. Maybe not the Oval Office itself, but certainly in the White House. And, you know, my book is at least a third of it has to do with those sorts of games as opposed to high-stakes tournament televised poker.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about that, though, the high-stakes televised poker.
Well, in 1970, Benny Binion, a Texan who had moved to Las Vegas, and seven of his Texas cronies got together, and they inaugurated the first World Series of poker. And the game to play, naturally, was Texas Hold'em. And since then, that tournament has gotten more and more publicity. Seven players compete in 1970. By the year 2000, when I first played in the tournament, there were 512 players, and you know, this year the main event drew, I think, 7,500 players. It has grown exponentially, especially with the advent of the whole card cameras, which were developed by a Holocaust survivor by the name of Henry Orenstein in the late 1990s. Shows the whole cards to the TV audience. Before Orenstein's cameras became available, watching professional pokers play was sort of like watching bears hibernate and smoke. You know, they were extremely effective. You know, first of all, smoking in poker tournaments was permitted, and that pretty much stopped around 2002, 2003. And the players were expert at not giving away any information about their hole cards, so that the audience watching doesn't know who's bluffing and who has a powerful hand and is slow playing it, trying to trap his opponent. Whereas now, poker is not only much more dramatic to watch, but it's actually educational. The audience gets to see a player like Phil Ivey or Daniel Negreanu, how they take very weak starting cards and dominate the hand with the force of their bets, as the size of their bets, as opposed to the strength of their cards.
So you're saying that if you are a poker player or you're interested in learning about poker, that you could actually, by watching top players play, you can learn things that theoretically then would make you a better player.
There's no question. The World Series of Poker allows you to do that. an even better show as a learning opportunity is called High Stakes Poker, which is, I believe, on the Game Show Network these days, and in which the cash game, where they're not in a tournament with the blinds going up every hour or every 2 hours, the skill element is much higher. And when you see the very best players in the world compete with very weak hole cards against one another, and the ability to use money to leverage the size of the pot shows poker skill at the highest level.
Yeah, and just to, maybe to make sure for people who don't or are not into this or have followed it, this poker that we're talking about that is on television that's so popular, what happens is as the cards are dealt out, that each player is dealt some number of cards face up so that everybody knows what they are, and then they're dealt two cards that are face down. So
Not exactly. The game that is almost always showed on television is Texas Hold'em, even more commonly No Limit Texas Hold'em, uh-huh. which you can bet any amount. Each player starts with two face-down cards, their okay. whole cards. And then there are three come up in the middle of the board called the flop, and those are shared community cards.
Okay.
And then a fourth card, the turn card, then a fifth card, the river. And with the player's two cards combine with the five cards in the middle to make the best five-card poker hand.
So they're just, the point is that there are some cards that are out there on the table, and everybody knows what they are, but then each player has these two cards that that only they know, and of course, because they have this now this little technological thing, the people who are watching at home, they know what the cards are. The players know what their two cards are, but the other people around the table, all they know is what's what they've got and what's sitting their face up on the table.
Precisely. Right. Precisely.
And these are the games where essentially there are, if at some point, if you want to bet everything you've got, you can bet everything you've got.
Mm-hmm. So the skill factor. More pots in No Limit Hold'em are won by players not holding the best, the most powerful hand. But the intimidation factor, the ability to drive opponents out of a pot when they might have a better hand than you, is much greater in No Limit Hold'em than in other games.
And here, I guess this gets at this thing that's the essence, so much the essence of the game, and the way that it translates into other sort of risky ventures, the bluff.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can't, as we try to figure out what's going on with Iran's nuclear program, with the North Koreans, virtually none of those discussions in newspapers or in conversations in living rooms take place without the word bluff being used.
Yeah.
Bluffing is at the heart of game theory as it is formulated by Johnny von Neumann and Oscar Morgenstern in the 1940s, and that is the mathematical basis for defense policy and diplomacy since the Cold War, when we were facing off with first the Soviets, then the Chinese, and then with a larger and larger number of countries that were nuclear armed. Very, very important that you have a rigorous logical/mathematical system for figuring out what's the most effective way to proceed. And before that, most people had thought of chess as the game that was most analogous to military and diplomatic strategy. But in the 50s and 60s, Oscar Morgenstern showed how poker was much more lifelike game that allowed people to understand the nature of warfare, because chess is a game of complete information, which is very much unlike a diplomatic or military face-off.
Mm.
Whereas
mm-hmm.
poker, with the incomplete information, the whole cards known only to one player, is much more representative. That the kind of poker, the kind of logic that a poker player uses, is extremely similar to what a diplomat or a military strategist would use.
We're at a midpoint here. Our guest is James McManus. He's written a lot about poker, the game as it's played today, its history, poker and literature. He's covered the game for many publications, the New York Times, the LA Times, Harper's, the New Yorker. He's the author of the book Positively Fifth Street, which was a memoir of his fifth place finish in the World Series of Poker Championship, and that was in 2003. His new book is a history of the game. It's titled Cowboys Full, The Story of Poker, and it's published by Ferrer, Strauss, and Giroux. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's someone in Effingham on our line four. Hello.
Yes, poker and gambling in general seems benign, you know, the actual games. But I'm wondering if your guest might address the subject of addiction to gambling. And as he just said, to war.
Well, can you do that?
I heard the first part of the question, the addiction to gambling. What was the second one?
Well, it was war. Now, I'm not exactly sure how those things are connected. Maybe they are.
I thought we were talking about poker's applications in military and diplomatic situations. Certainly, as far as the addiction is concerned, it is a serious problem. People, across the globe become addicted to food, nicotine, alcohol. Gambling is certainly one of the things, and it can be a very serious problem. There's no question that the, people have lost too much money playing poker, just like they've lost it at the track or playing lotteries or blackjack or casino games. The fact is that I think poker is less dangerous for an addictive personality because of the skill factor. If you are playing a game in which is almost purely dominated by luck, such as roulette, the need for your mind to figure out the ideal strategy probably makes it less susceptible to addictive, compulsive behavior. That said, the online sites where most poker game is now being played are working with the government in order to regulate and tax poker games and put into place programs which can detect compulsive addictive gambling, as well as games being played by minors. And everything possible is being done to keep problem gamblers out of casinos and offline. Certainly, there is a lot of work still to be done in that area, but we're never going to be able to keep addicts out of any field, whether it's food, booze, drugs, so it remains an unideal situation. But I don't think the addictive nature of poker is any more severe than in other walks of life.
All right. Thank the caller. I want to go on to somebody else here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hello. Am I on?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, hi. My question was, you mentioned that bluffing is an important part of poker and that the best players actually win because they're good bluffers rather than having strong hands. I guess that makes sense because statistically nobody should get a better hand than anybody else in any regular way. But so I guess what I'm trying to figure out is if bluffing is so important and the good players bluff well, it's going to be known that they are bluffers and good bluffers. Doesn't that eventually somehow work against them? I can't quite understand that.
Well, eventually, not only eventually, but immediately, the fact remains that many bluffs will be called and you will lose hands that you were bluffing ineffectively on. It is a tactic which has a high degree of, its success rate is variable. But the more often you are able to bluff effectively, the more successful you will be. And certainly there's a luck factor. If I'm trying to bluff you and you have, if you have three aces in your hand, you're probably not going to fold your hand. So I may have picked the spot that seemed like a good opportunity to bluff, but the bottom line is it was my bad luck that you happened to be dealt a good hand when I was bluffing. So there's hundreds and hundreds of variables that go into determining who's going to bluff more effectively than not. And, of course, if you overuse it, people will call every time you bet because they've got you marked down as a bluffer. You have to find the ideal number of times and not overuse the tactic.
Okay, I understand that. So then, are there actually been analysis done of high-stakes game to see to what percent of the winnings is actually due to a good hand? I mean, the luck part. I mean, is there a way to try to figure that out? Well, how much of it is luck and how much it is the skill?
That is an ongoing investigation, not only in courts but among poker players who are trying to maximize the profitability of their bluffs. You want to bluff you want to try to achieve randomness in bluffing so that no one can pick up a pattern about when you are. And as far as the government wanting to know what the ratio between skill and luck is, many judges are, since what constitutes legal gambling or illegal gambling often comes down to the question of whether it is a game of skill or of luck. And games of skill are generally thought of as contests that should be legal. And so it's up to poker players to demonstrate that poker is more a game of skill than it is of luck.
Okay, very interesting. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. When I asked you about what it takes to be a really great player, one of the things you talked about was your ability to read the people that you're playing with, to get whatever you can, nonverbal stuff, off of them that would give you some idea of what's, you know, what kind of hand they're holding and what they're doing. I know that you play a lot online, and there's a lot of online playing going on now. If you're playing online, you're losing all that.
Right. That's the big sea change in poker. There's been many major turning points in the history of poker, but certainly early in the 21st century, as more a higher and higher percentage of games are played online, read faces and bodies for tells, and even to hear the sound of voices. I mean, you use the term nonverbal, but a big part of tell reading in the past has had to do with engaging in a conversation with your opponent who might be bluffing. If they've made a big bet, you would try to have a conversation with them. Why are you betting so much? I mean, do you have a straight? Have you already made your straight? And noticing how they responded, the tone of their voices, their voice, their breathing pattern, whether or not they chose to remain silent, were all important parts in figuring out whether or not they were bluffing or telling the truth. And online, that opportunity has disappeared. It becomes much more mathematical what the pot odds say you should do, as well as pattern reading. Somebody bets, somebody's playing raising half the hands that they enter the pot with, they're obviously lowering their standards for what a good hand is. So the ability to play well online is quite a bit different from the ability to play well in person.
Hmm. Is it, I know that you've done some writing about computers and their ability at the game. Would it be possible, say you're playing online, would it actually be possible to take advantage of what a computer could do for you? And could you then be playing online and at the point where then you have to make some sort of choice about what you're going to do, could you ask the computer, okay, what should I do here? And is that something that could be an aid, maybe not today, but at some point could be an aid to players?
Well, that's one of the biggest fears, that bots, as they are called, people write computer software in order to tell them what to do. And in fact, the more sophisticated version of a bot, you can plug it right into your computer and it can play the game for you when you're not even in the room. If you give it your strategic and tactical guidelines, it will implement them. And the sites bend over backwards in order to detect when somebody is using a bot and to keep those bots offline. Poker strategy has been very important in the development of artificial intelligence, and people, particularly Darce Billings at the University of Alberta, has led a team that has developed software that can beat the very good players, not the best in the world, but A or A-minus players in games of limit hold'em or other limit games where the size of the betting is smaller. When a computer program goes up against a no-limit hold'em player, an A-plus world-class pro, they will still lose. Whereas, of course, in chess, the most sophisticated computer program, IBM's Deep Blue, can beat the very best chess players in the world. Mm-hmm. Poker, especially the no-limit version, is a more complex game, and that is why the humans are still better than the robots.
Well, going back
how long that's going to last is...
Open to question?
Yes, very much so.
Well, going back to humans, humans and playing, one of the things that really emerges from the book very clearly, and we've touched on that, is that the long association between poker and politics and politicians, and there are so many great stories. I guess the one that sort of jumped out at me was the story about Richard Nixon. Apparently, Nixon, of our presidents, was one of the best poker players, and when he played in the Navy, and he won, for the time, he won quite a bit of money.
The discussion you and I have been having began with a discussion of friendly games among regular folks as well as presidents.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that two presidents played poker for rather high stakes, and they were the two guys who shared the 1952 and 56 Republican ticket, Richard Nixon and Dwight Eisenhower. Eisenhower, his favorite game was poker, and he earned enough to buy his dress uniforms to court the wealthy debutante Mamie Dowd, with whom he could not have spent much time if he didn't have some cash jingling in his pockets. Nixon famously won $8,000 in 44 and 45 while serving in the Navy, and that amount was sufficient to fund his first congressional campaign. That was a lot of money to win in a poker game in the mid-1940s. And that was the sole financial basis of his political career.
Also, apparently, Bill Gates was a big player when he was in college, and I think that you write that he apparently some of his winnings actually helped to start Microsoft.
Gates himself wrote, and I quote him in my book, that he feels as much as he learned in his classes at Harvard, he learned even more in the dormitory poker games, where he learned how to crunch numbers, information about people, and devise a strategy about how to play his hand. He thought that was extremely useful in developing a business strategy down the road. And perhaps of even greater importance is the fact that he won a significant fraction of the startup costs for Microsoft playing in his Harvard dormitory.
Mm. I'm just—it's endlessly fascinating. All of these, the ways that the poker thinking, poker terminology gets into American politics. I mean, certainly in language, there are sports terms, and there are terms that come from football, and there are terms that come from baseball. But maybe I hadn't really thought about it that much. There are a lot of expressions that we use that come from poker.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you give up a situation, you fold. If you're misrepresenting the strength of your hand or your position, you're bluffing. A blue chip game is similar to a blue chip stock. The more colorful, the more loudly colorful a chip is, the more valuable it is in a poker game. And, the list goes on and on and on. You got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them. And there's just hundreds and hundreds of poker terms that have made their way into American English.
Yeah, and I hadn't really thought about it, but the New Deal, what we're talking about there is like dealing out a new hand.
Well, the two Roosevelt presidents, Teddy Roosevelt named his far-reaching poker, not poker, his social programs, the Square Deal, in which he said he wasn't going to fix the economy so that any one group was going to succeed, but that he was going to guarantee that there would be no cheating. Everyone would have an equal opportunity to prosper in the American economy. And about 30 years later, his fifth cousin, Franklin Roosevelt, nicknamed the most sweeping social program ever in American history, the New Deal. And both of those men chose that term because they knew they were trying to connect with the citizenry, and they knew that by the turn of the century, and certainly by the 1930s, that poker was part and parcel with the American thought process. So they chose poker terms to describe their programs.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. James McManus is our guest. He's covered poker for many publications, New York Times, L.A. Times, Harper's Magazine, The New Yorker. Has written about his playing poker in the 2003 World Series. He wrote a book about that, Positively Fifth Street, and has a new book out that looks at the history of poker in America that's titled Cowboys Full, and it's published by Farrah Straus Giroux. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. When you were thinking about doing this, I guess maybe you wanted to make sure that there was no other such book, and that you apparently were kind of surprised, given how important poker seems to be in America, that nobody had written this book before.
Yeah, I was startled. Positively Fifth Street I wrote between 2000 and 2003, and I wanted to have as much. It was about a murder trial and about my action at the 2000 World Series of Poker, and I wanted to have as much background on the game as I could to get people to understand the kind of thought processes that were involved. And I went looking for a history of poker or two, and I was pretty surprised to discover that there was no single volume story of the game. There are snatches of poker history in a large variety of books, but no single volume book. So my publisher and I figured out that it might make sense, given the fact that poker is certainly America's card game and arguably America's national pastime, not in terms of number of people who watch it, but in terms of the number of people who actually play. Football and baseball are not games that a large number of people play tackle football or country hardball the way that they play in Major League Baseball, but lots and lots of people, probably 80 or 100 million people have been in this country alone, have played the game, so that there wasn't an account of its beginnings and the way that it evolved and the point that it had reached by the year 2000 was, I think that I felt that there was a vacuum that needed to be filled.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with some more folks here. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. What do you think of the chances the online gaming legislation will pass for allow poker playing on the computer?
I think that they're good. Barney Frank and the Professional Poker Players Alliance, the Poker Players Alliance, have been working in Washington very diligently since 2006 to overthrow the law that was snuck into the legal code by Bill Frist and a couple of other congressmen. They attached it to the Safe Ports Act, a bill that they knew no one could vote against. They knew that they couldn't have enough support among their fellow congressmen and senators to get it passed, so they attached it at the 11th hour to another bill. And since then, the banking industry and most politicians have agreed that it was a very bad law. And now Barney Frank and his colleagues in Congress have come up with a bill that would regulate and tax the online sites to make sure that they're behave in as legitimate a fashion as possible, keep underage gamblers and problem gamblers off the sites, and also generate billions of dollars of tax income. So I am optimistic that that this legislation is going to make its way through and be signed by the president.
Okay,
oh,
well,
that's great. That's wonderful.
Thanks for the call. That does indeed get at this question that right now people are doing it. You're doing it. A lot of other people are playing poker online for money, and that it is technically, I think, is illegal, isn't it?
The bill was written very unclearly and illogically. It remains legal to actually sit at your computer and play the game. What the legal gray area is whether a bank can transfer money from your account onto the site, or if you win money from the site into your account. The actual playing of the game while you're on the site seems to, no one has ever been arrested or indicted for that, but the ability to move money around from banks to online sites is where the legal gray area currently exists.
Hmm. If it wasn't for the money, nobody would do it. So I guess we're that's
correct. Although many people play online for what is called play money, and most of the sites have .net. Manifestations in which people come on and play for free.
Hmm. I guess going back to the, I suppose if you just really like to play, there would be something enticing about that. But I find myself going back to one of your earlier comments about, well, really, even friendly games, if there weren't pennies at stake, you know, nobody would do it. What would the point be?
That is certainly true, unless there's the pride factor. Poker for zero money tends to become much more of a luck game, and also if there's nothing at stake, it's harder to keep people's interest focused on what's going on. So I agree with what I said earlier, mm-hmm. not surprisingly, that poker makes much more sense if there's at least a little bit at stake.
There's so much great stuff in the book. You have a section here on the book where you talk about the history of cheating and some of the methods that were used by professional players to cheat. What sort of things did people do?
A very wide variety of things. They dealt over mirrors. They had rings that they flipped around on their finger that had mirrors so that when they were dealing, they could see the bottom of the card to the people that they were dealing them to. They had cold decks, decks that were pre-sequenced in order to give one player four kings, another four queens, and then, of course, the dealer or his confederate in the game would have four aces. So two or three people would have extremely powerful hands. They'd bet all their money, and then the person would turn over the four aces. We saw that most famously in The Sting, in which Robert Shaw has prepared a cold deck for Paul Newman. Robert Shaw is going to have four nines, and Paul Newman is going to have a full house. But Paul Newman and his cronies get the drop on Doyle Lonergan, played by Robert Shaw, and they introduce a double cold deck in which Robert Shaw gets his four nines, but Paul Newman has four jacks, turns him over and says, "You owe me 15 grand, pal." And that is the first time that Robert Shaw's money gets transferred into Gondorf's crew's hands, and that's how they eventually take Robert Shaw for all of his money.
Hmm. Tell me about the dogs playing poker. When did that? Who started that?
That was a guy named C.M. Coolidge, Cassius Marcellus Coolidge, who was born not long after the Civil War, and by the turn of the century, he had been commissioned by a Minnesota calendar company, a Minneapolis calendar company, to produce paintings that would advertise cigars and whiskey, and he chose a series of images of dogs playing poker. It was, you know, the humor factor. It was a game that was widely played by people who drank whiskey and beer and smoked cigars. Poker was the perfect way to capture their interest. And he put dogs into a series of poker situations. There's a bluff. There's cheating going on, and one card is an ace of spades is being passed from a boxer to a Dalmatian, and they became subsequently icons of American kitsch. And to own one of these paintings, of course, we all have the calendars. We've all seen the calendars. But to actually own one of these paintings, it costs you about $500,000 right now.
Really? So there actually are the original paintings of these things exist, and they're that valuable?
Absolutely. And the you know, they've become a wonderful example of how low art gets transmogrified because of various cultural factors into high art, or at least high kitsch.
Coming back to professional people who play professionally, what's the biggest pot anybody ever won?
Well, if you win the last hand at the World Series, in 2006, Jamie Gold won the final hand of that event, and that won him $12 million. Of course, he didn't just win it on that one hand. I personally lost a pot worth $1.1 million at the 2000 World Series. I had a much better hand going in. I had ace-queen, and Hassan Habib called me. He went all in with ace-four. I called him with ace-queen. So only one of the there were three fours in the deck that could beat me, and one of them came on the river, and that cost me a pretty penny. There are pots online now every night. Every 4 or 5 minutes, there's a $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000 pot online. If you go to fulltiltpoker.com, you see the big games played by Phil Ivey and Tom Dwan and Patrick Antonius, in which there are huge amounts of money changing hands every 15 or 20 minutes. And certainly million-dollar swings occur every evening.
So when you were playing in that game, and here at this point you were a pretty experienced player, so it's not everybody is going to sit down and play a hand where there was $1 million on the table. What did that feel like when you were sitting there and you were thinking, here's a $1 million, I could take this money away?
Well, there were tournament chips in that case. We were playing for, there was about $1.1 million worth of World Series of Poker championship chips in the pot. The total prize pool we were playing was $5.12 million. So they were worth roughly dollar per dollar. At that point, I was good for $250,000 prize money. I was trying to do better than that. There were only five players left at the table. And you do think in flashes that if I could just take this $250,000 out, I could pay off my mortgage and buy a car, but you pretty much remain in the moment. Your money, the chips are your weapons in order to defeat your opponent, and so it's a strange twilight zone between actual practical value and your ability to have the tools, i.e. the chips, in order to continue trying to win the whole event.
And that's James McManus. He's the author of the book Cowboys Full. It's a history of poker in America, a show that we first broadcast November 30th of last year. WILL programming made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering coffee roasted daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Also offering a variety of tea and chai, open Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m., Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information available at 352-9713. We'll break for an update on the markets. We'll be back, so stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where in Kansas City and Chicago, we're seeing some modest strength with prices a little bit firmer than they were off of the opening bell. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars in Kansas City. March wheat now at 495.5, up 5.5. July, 518, up 5. March wheat at the Board of Trade, 491, up 8.75. July, 514, up 4. March corn, 360.5, up 2. May, 371.75, up 1.5. July, 382.25, up 1.5. December, 395.25, up 1.75. March beans, 933, up 8.5. May, 941.5, up 6.25. July, 949, and they are up 5. Take it out and go ahead and look at the November contract. November beans at 914.75, up 2.25. March soybean meal, 274, up 340. March soybean oil, 3840. It is up 2.